Review Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Take the calls in the other room. Now, these guys, you're now going to see one of the reasons why that I took the time to go through it in such detail. The writers of this book, Bagehot Lee and Lincoln, are so typical of what confronts people in the academic world. There is something about normal history per se. I don't know why I got a feedback. So listen, Mike, and talk to the guy. I don't know what there is about it, but learned, capable, careful, objective, and honest in every other way people go bananas when they get on religion. That's why this crusade is so important, to prove that you don't park your brains at the door of a church when you go in. There's been too many people in the church that are anti-intellectual. Until a certain frame of reference is created, that the kind of disciplined, careful, thorough research that people pride themselves in doing in other areas before they give an opinion or speak on a subject, they just throw out the window. Have you ever seen a very dignified person get drunk? In a sense, the intelligentsia of this world have such erratic symptoms when they shift from normal disciplines to religion. Something happens to them. Some demon comes into their chemistry. And shamelessly, men who would never imply expertise in an area they didn't qualify themselves in, men who would never give pontifical and opinionated statements without much research, just launch off like a cannon shot when they get into religion, because for some reason they think that that area doesn't require an equal diligence, an equal intelligence, an equal care, an equal approach to facts, an equal breadth of research before you come to a conclusion. And that's why kids lose their faith in universities. Now, I've often distinguished between what I call logical guilt and psychological guilt. Someone can be logically guilty, but not psychologically guilty. They just are not consciously aware of their guilt. And that's what I think these academicians do. I think they have a priori drawn a conclusion that religion is for the simple-minded, that religion is simple, and you don't have to apply their best to it. So they just slide into a state they're not even consciously aware of. And the normal disciplines and the normal care, and the reason being, they know the way they're going to be taken to task by people they respect. Musicians play music for musicians. You can have 1,000 people there, one famous musician sitting in the audience, and the musicians on the stage will only be aware of that one musician. Newsmen care more about the opinion of their peers than they do the opinion of the whole world. So when people approach this kind of subject matter, they're going to be careful the way they handle the normal historic content, because they do not want to be taken to task by the rest of their disbelieving peers. But when they get on the religious area, the ones that know enough to contest with them are not their peers, and they don't care about their opinion anyway. So they get away with it. This book becomes an embryo of what your children face when they go to university, which is why they need to have some preparation for the idea that Christianity requires some brain energy too. The ability to counteract this asininity. Now, I really respect these authors in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, until they start dealing with the, quote, holy aspects. And we've seen the way they've handled the Holy Grail. That was the first crack in their armor. As long as they were handling simple French history, they would leave no stone unturned. They would again and again tell us there were still questions before they'd draw a conclusion. When they get to the Christian content, they give the conclusions first, most of them erroneous, no support. But they have built a confidence in the reader by the thoroughness and skill of their early research that, if you don't watch it, carries over to people who don't know the truth. You will slide right into their conclusions and say, well, you know, scholars like this wouldn't say this if it didn't have real research behind it. Well, scholars like this did say it, and there wasn't any real research behind it. Now, tonight I had considered getting on. Remember when we taught on the Holy Blood, Holy Grail? I mean, taught on the Spear of Destiny? Well, Trevor Ravenscroft has also written on the Cup of Destiny, because he studied under one of the mystical philosophers, Dr. Walter Johann Stein, who for 7 years he studied under on the mystical teachings, more or less, of the great romances of the Grail. If they had just read, they don't even have to read the Christian normal King Arthur-y side of things. They just looked into this. They would have known they were weak in their study of the Grail. And I don't agree with Ravenscroft either. But I do agree that he's grabbed hold of an understanding of the mystical meanings that are conveyed in the Grail romances. I'll read just a little bit before I get to where I left off, the Gospels. The two great romances of the Middle Ages, this is by Trevor Ravenscroft, The Cup of Destiny, The Quest for the Grail. His better book is The Spear of Destiny, where he traces the legends and beliefs and influence of the so-called spear that pierced the side of Jesus down through history. It was pursued by Charlemagne, it was pursued by Napoleon. An onlooker described an experience by Adolf Hitler that can only be compared to demon possession when he looked on it, and he had to have it, which can explain why he took some of his earliest moves with his blitzkrieg. And old Smiley Eisenhower gave it back to the Russians. The legend was that whomever possessed this spear would conquer the world. Doesn't matter whether it's true or not. A lot of people have believed it, and their commitment to that has made them try. But Eisenhower sent it back to the Eastern Bloc. It would pay, and it's one of my crusades to point this out, more people to realize that an intelligent understanding of religion and its traditions and heritages and facts is distinct from traditions. It'd pay anybody that's going to do anything of influence in this world to understand religion. It's too bad that the dimwits have moved to center stage, and the turkeys have gobbled it into an attitude on the part of the intelligentsia that is just all noise and no substance. Religion is a profound stream of influence in this world, and it's too cold. The two great romances of the Middle Ages were Wolfram von Eschenbach and Creechin de Troyes. Concealed within their pages, a prescribed path to self-knowledge for the Western world. Turn it off for a minute, Mike. McCrever starts out, Ravenscroft starts out, understanding going out the gate that it was a vehicle for hidden meanings. It was never intended to be read with surface meaning any more than a code during the war was to be read with surface meaning. You break the code and it conveyed a hidden meaning. The two great romances of the Middle Ages by Wolfram von Eschenbach and Creechin de Troyes conceal within their pages a prescribed path to self-knowledge for the Western world, the quest for the Grail. It is tragic indeed that the real message in these superlative works has been lost. The dry intellectualism of modern scholarship, while recognizing the literary merit inherent in them, regards both these sagas of the Grail as little more than enchanting tales of the adventures of knights and their ladies against the colorful background of the courts of the Middle Ages. There is a growing feeling among the younger generation that these sagas veil within their drama and symbolism a unique path of initiation into the very deepest mysteries of Christianity, and is for this audience that the cup of destiny has been written. Its aim is to reveal in the gradually unfolding commentary the way in which the human soul may become a bridge between two worlds, the world of the senses and the world of the spirit. Now, going out the gate, that's why these approaches to the Grail romances attracted the Gnostics, or like the chicken and the egg, could have been the product of Gnostic thought. Because Gnosticism assumes a spatial source of knowledge, and salvation is by that knowledge. These particular interpretations in this book are not necessarily the right ones, but at least they start out right. They recognize it has a hidden message, and it is more akin to those initiation messages down through history of the progress of the soul, as the ancient priests of Egypt, who didn't truly understand the prophetic meanings of the pyramid, at least they understood that it was an initiation path of man on the wrong downward road being delivered and following the path of the soul through the truth and darkness, through the truth and light into the king's chamber and the open tomb that reaches into eternity. They understood that. And the Grail stories were more probably in their meaning related to that than anything else. And if anything happened among the Merovingians, they Merovingianized these Grail romances and utilized them as a conveyance belt for their own political aspirations, not the other way around. The Grail romances became a very convenient vehicle for the priori de Sion to utilize, as the fish symbol became convenient for the early Christians to utilize for their purposes. There's a mountain being made out of a molehill, and on occasions a mountain given forth a mouse when it conceives in this Holy Blood, Holy Grail thing. At least this book comes to grip with the symbolic meanings. And it does a little more to give you a background which you may have been intrigued into by their cryptic references and selective references in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So I'm going to read just a little ways quickly. The purpose of this reading is, again, to just... Well, let me say it. I always teach for a gestalt. The gestalt in what I'm doing now is not that you'll remember what I'm saying, but that a certain critical perspective will begin to hone itself toward the writings in this Holy Blood, Holy Grail book. They're so thorough up till now, I want to show you that they start to crack when they begin to oversimplify the Grail romances and then even more oversimplify the Christian message. Now, it's too hot. So let's just show you what someone who knows a little more about these Grail romances has to say. Instead of hunt and peck quotes, you get a little synthesis. There are two apparently opposing views or points of view concerning the focal point of the Grail itself in the works of Creech and Dutroux and Wolfram von Essenbach. According to Creech, the Grail appears as a golden vessel ornamented with precious stones which contains a wafer within it. According to Wolfram von Essenbach, the Grail is symbolized by a stone of light brought down from heaven by angel hosts, whose wonder-working power is renewed every Good Friday when a wafer is laid by an angel on the stone. Creech and Dutroux, who wrote his account of the Grail in about 1180, tells us that he used as his source material a Latin book which he obtained from Philip of Alsace, Count of Flanders. He dedicated his work to his patron. The source has never been doubted because Philip of Alsace is a known historical personality. He joined the Crusaders in 1188. Interesting date. Reached the Holy Land in 1190 and died the same year. But Creech never finished his work, which breaks off suddenly. How Parzival came to the castle of the Grail for the second time, how he became king of the Grail, and of the origin of the Grail itself, he tells us nothing. Creech died before he could finish the work. Wolfram von Essenbach, on the other hand, did fully complete his Parzival. His work, which has one of the widest scopes of any literary work of medieval times, appeared some 20 years after that of Creech. There is an unquestionable similarity in plot, characters, and incident to Creech's romances, but Wolfram denies he used this as a source. Indeed, he, Wolfram, claims that he could neither read nor write, and did not even know a single letter of the alphabet. Quote, "If the women would not take it for flattery," Wolfram says, "I would add further unknown words to this story for you. I would continue the adventure for you. But if anyone requests me to do so, let him not consider it a book. I do not know a single letter of the alphabet. Plenty of people get their material that way, but this adventure steers without books. Rather than have anybody think it is a book, I would sit naked without a towel the way I would sit in the bath, dash, if I didn't forget the fig leaf. This short passage, which appears at the end of Book 2, is regarded as the greatest enigma in medieval literature. The answer to this riddle, which is crucial to the true understanding of the whole work, has evaded scholars across the centuries and still remains unanswered to this day. The scholars ask themselves, how could a poet whose work is at least as profound as the Divine Comedy, and who probably encompasses a broader and more comprehensive canvas of human experience than Dante himself, possibly claim to be illiterate? How could a poet who was the very first in the history of European literature to present a continuing story which illustrates the gradual inner development of its hero possibly be unable either to read or to write? How could this greatest of all the many singers who somehow managed to transcend his own medieval tradition to paint an almost modern picture of childhood, adolescence, love, and marriage, possibly claimed to be ignorant of the alphabet. A satisfactory solution to this riddle becomes yet more crucial when the structure of the poem itself is considered. Now, this gets important. Listen close. It is without doubt a most meticulously structured work, outshining all contemporary works both in the artistry of its patterns and in its numerical precision. The poem is divided into 16 books. Each book, a unit in itself, is subdivided into paragraph-like sections of 30 lines each. The Gamuret Prelude, which tells the story of the adventures of the father of Parzival, is divided into 108 sections. There are 324, that is 3 times 108, sections covering the destiny of Parzival before his visit to the hermitage of the age Trevirizant in the Book 9, and this is followed by 324 sections in which Parzival atones for his errors and finally earns the kingship of the Grail. Book 9, which is the fulcrum of the whole story, follows an altogether different numerical pattern and numbers exactly 70 sections. Needless to say, the riddle presented in the laws of numbers appertaining to this Grail poem also remains unsolved to the present day. Perhaps it's because contemporary scholarship only understands the quantitative and not the qualitative meaning of number. We will demonstrate later in this work how the numerical structure of the poem has a macrocosmic significance, reflecting in astrological and alchemical terms the ordering of the planets and star constellations associated with the quest for the Grail. Did you follow that? Now, all I really wanted to accomplish in the Gestalt at this moment is you don't just sort of grab a few phrases here and there from the Grail romances and think you've got them summarized. And why do you think most people go through life and say, well, it was a Grail, maybe it was a cup, maybe it... They may go so far as to remember Mallory in the English context, that it might be the cup that caught Jesus' blood or the cup of the Last Supper, somehow connected to Joseph of Arimathea, maybe Mary Magdalene, King Arthur's court, chivalry, and knights going out to find honor. That's about all you know. It's about all anybody can bother to teach. Because you open it up, you've got something as complicated and full of symbolism and as difficult and challenging to try to find alternative decipherments of as the pyramid itself. The Grail romances are analogous in the Middle Ages in difficulty of interpretation and potentiality of symbolic meaning as the Book of Revelation in the New Testament. Books full of symbols. Now, the question that is being faced and the one that is obviously concluded by the writers of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, they conclude that the Grail romances were the product of the Merovingians and designed somehow to cloak to the uninitiated and reveal to the initiated that their power was related to this secret bloodline that goes back to the natural son of Jesus. Look at me so strange. All I wanted to do was read a few pages from just one book. I bought one here last night where the author has written a book as big as Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the entire research of which is designed to show that the Grail is but a medieval carrying forward of the ancient Welsh and Irish concept of the Creel. Here we have another writer that's going to develop the meaning of the Grail romances in the long-standing Gnostic and mystical and hermetic thought patterns of the progress of an initiate through degrees of experience to the enlightened position of the soul that somehow strikes a contact with ultimate reality while still living in the world of time. That's as old as the Vedantas in India and the Buddhists in Asia, who seek to strike through some degree of progressive experiences an ability to reach out of the wheel of life and the wheel of time and touch ultimate reality in nirvana, which is a state of being that puts you in touch with the ultimate that they'll not even define, while still being tied a bit here. All I'm saying is, equally legitimate, the Grail romances are but a long-standing tradition developed by a mystical side of Christianity of the progress of the soul. In a certain sense, every heresy of the church has a germ of truth. There is little question but what the New Testament gives a valid basis for the charismatic and Pentecostal experiences. But as Reinhold Niebuhr has once said, both the second definite work of grace, sanctification people, and the Pentecostals have taken an experience that ought to produce a greater degree of sinlessness and have turned it into a vehicle of the most vicious sin, spiritual pride. But in its genuine form, it is a progression. We become new creations in Christ Jesus, and the old man passed away, and we touch eternity. And Paul obviously had an experience that he couldn't even put in words. He was caught up in the third heaven. There was a legitimacy to this progressive spiritual experience that can be carried to an illegitimate extreme. And it's always the trick of Satan to take anything that's legitimate and bend it out of shape. The Grail romances could have been Christian attempts to put into romantic form and capture the imagination of the people what the modern Christian Missionary Alliance prophet A.W. Tozier so eloquently called the pursuit of God. They could have been Gnostic expressions in an age that hunted down Gnostics as heretics to cloak their spiritual truths that still came out of ancient Egypt and through Mithraism, the mystery religions, in order that it could be practiced in secret as the New Testament Christians used the fish to hide themselves, or it could be the Merovingian tendency. We'll be back. Joined us right now, I'm in the middle of getting ready, really, to continue with Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I get amused at how quickly people forget that listen to me teach all the time that I am committed to a theory of learning called field theory in English, Gestalt theory to use the German word, that is the exact opposite of the normal approach to learning where you learn the way you build a brick wall, brick on top of brick on top of brick. Rather, I drop the whole bundle of bricks on you. And while you're fighting to try to recover from the shock, an insight comes at some point where bricks can be organized instead of being a mindless stacking of the bricks, and you can learn with understanding. You put the field together. But in spite of my reiterating that, once I have produced a certain gestalt, and then I take off for a while, and together we fit the bricks in with the frame of reference established, I come to a point where I got to hit you with a new gestalt, and you have the exact same shock look every time. Like, what the hell is he talking about? Everything I said the previous 30 minutes, I have no intention of anybody remembering. It was designed to create a felt awareness that these guys in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, when they got on the Christian frame, first the Grail concepts, and then now we're just getting into it, the Gospels, they tend to oversimplify. Whereas they themselves took the oversimplified approach to history and blew it apart and with such support that it could not be questioned, they showed us things in history